From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the repercussions of a spy scandal. American Jonathan Pollard is serving a life sentence for selling his country's secrets to Israel. Wolf Blitzer is one of only two journalists who has interviewed Pollard in prison. Blitzer is Washington bureau chief for the Jerusalem Post and author of a new book about the Pollard case. Also today, we meet writer Lynn Sharon Schwartz. Her new novel, Leaving Brooklyn, is about a young girl looking for something more adventurous than the security of her parents' middle-class life. Rock critic Ken Tucker is back with the Tucker Top 5, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Field of Dreams, a baseball fantasy starring Kevin Costner. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Jonathan Pollard is the only American ever convicted of spying on his own country for Israel, a close ally of the U.S. Pollard spied for Israel while he was working for American Naval Intelligence. This gave him access to classified documents, thousands of which he turned over to Israel, including U.S. reconnaissance photos of PLO headquarters in Tunisia. Those photos helped Israel bomb the headquarters in October of 1985. When Pollard realized the Americans were onto him, he and his wife fled to the Israeli embassy seeking asylum. But to their shock, they were thrown out. The moment they left the embassy, they were arrested by the FBI. My guest, Wolf Blitzer, is the Washington bureau chief for the Jerusalem Post. Blitzer, who is an American, has been covering the Pollard case since the story broke in November of 1985. He's written a new book about this spy scandal and its repercussions called Territory of Lies. Blitzer was the only reporter allowed to interview Pollard while he was in prison awaiting sentencing. Blitzer interviewed Pollard twice. The first interview took place on November 20th, 1986.
Actually, I had tried to get in to interview him shortly after his arrest a year earlier, but on the advice of his lawyers, Pollard didn't grant any interviews. He was taking a very low profile. He was going to cooperate eventually with the U.S. government and plea bargain, and then participate in the interrogation and the polygraph and the damage containment. He didn't speak out publicly. Only one side of the story really was coming out, the government side. And Pollard, while sitting in prison, was increasingly getting upset because he felt that his motivations had been distorted. He wanted to make clear that he was not motivated to become a spy for Israel by the money. The money only came in later. His original motivation was ideological. He felt that vital information, which Israel needed, was not being officially shared by the U.S. government with Israel, and he decided to do it on his own. He wanted to get that message across, and after some discussion with his wife, his father-in-law, Bernie Henderson, actually came to my office early in November of 86 and told me Pollard's side of the story, which really, as I said, had not come out, and suggested that I make another attempt to get into the prison to interview Pollard, and I did. I called the warden at the federal prison in Petersburg, Virginia. I wrote letters, and to my surprise, Pollard agreed, and the warden agreed, and I managed to get in and spent 3 hours with Jonathan Pollard on November 20th, 1986.
Now, you were allowed in and allowed in with a camera and a tape recorder. Why was it so surprising to you that you'd be allowed in so easily?
I was surprised because nobody had been in the prison. No reporter had been in the prison to interview Pollard in the year that after his arrest. And secondly, as part of his plea bargaining agreement, which had been released publicly earlier in June of 86, there had been a stipulation in there that he could not talk to the press or write articles or write books or disseminate information based on his years in naval intelligence without the authority of the director of naval intelligence, given the fact that he still had classified information presumably in his head. And Pollard had signed that agreement, which in effect made it possible to interview him only with the authority of the director of naval intelligence. And I assumed that the director of naval intelligence was not going to give that kind of authority. But I did manage to get into the prison, which is run by the federal government. The Bureau of Prisons is part of the Justice Department. So I assumed that when I got in, it had the authority of the U.S. government, obviously.
So that raises the question, which you've tried to come to terms with in your new book, were you used?
It does raise that question, and in the end, I've concluded that, yes, I probably was used.
By who and for what reasons?
I was probably used by both sides. I was probably used by the U.S. government. They let me in. I think they were, A, interested to see what Pollard would tell a reporter. B, I think they were interested in seeing if he was going to technically violate that plea bargaining agreement, because he personally did not have authority from the Director of Naval Intelligence to give that interview. And the government eventually did use that in trying to convince the sentencing judge to impose a harsher sentence on Jonathan Pollard. I was also used by Jonathan Pollard because his side of the story, as I said, had not come out. He wanted to express his sadness that the Israelis had not only abandoned him, but eventually betrayed him, and he was befuddled, he said. He was confused. And he wanted to underline, as I said, the point that he did not do this for the money. So I think both sides tried to use me in getting their sides of the story out. And I don't feel as if I betrayed any confidences or acted unprofessionally or irresponsibly. I think any reporter, especially a Washington-based reporter for an Israeli newspaper, covering this case from the moment that it exploded a year earlier, if granted an opportunity to interview the principal player involved, the spy, if you will, he or she would have grabbed that opportunity, and I, of course, did. So in the end, I may have been used, but I don't think that I acted irresponsibly or unprofessionally.
Do you think that your interview might have affected the outcome of the sentencing?
I know the judge was very angry at Jonathan Pollard for granting me those interviews. He made a big point on the day of the sentencing on March 4th, 1987, the judge in castigating Pollard for going ahead with those interviews, and he even recalled that Pollard did not even inform his own lawyers that he was going to be granting me this interview. It deeply angered the judge, and the government used it successfully in that respect. But my sense is the judge was much more influenced by the government's damage assessment, which was conveyed in camera, a classified 46-page document signed by the then Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, underlining the worst-case scenarios, the damage done to U.S. national security. I think that was much more important in convincing the judge to impose this maximum sentence on Jonathan Pollard than the interviews that he granted me.
Didn't the judge also say that he was struck by the lack of remorse that Pollard showed in his interview with you?
He did. He cited the fact that Pollard felt as if he had been a loyal son of Israel or an Israeli pilot. He gave that kind of an analysis. And the judge didn't feel that Jonathan Pollard had really shown a great deal of remorse in the course, not only of the interviews with me, but in his own personal statements to the judge, as in written statements to the judge, as well as in his personal statement that he made in the courtroom on that sentencing day.
So would you do a pre-sentencing interview again after your experience with the Pollard interview?
Yes, if the person who is being sentenced wants to speak out, as Jonathan Pollard clearly did, and B, if the U.S. government, the prison authorities, invited me in and allowed me to bring my camera and my tape recorder, and it was clear that this was an interview that was on the record, that was going to be published. If both sides say, in effect, that they don't have any problem with this kind of an interview, I don't think a journalist should be involved in a self-censoring decision like that and say, well, I don't think this is going to be helpful for either the government or for the defense, and not go in there and do the interview. I don't know any journalist who would turn down that kind of an opportunity, especially on a very, very sensitive and important story as this whole Pollard affair was.
Wolf Blitzer is my guest. He's the Washington bureau chief for the Jerusalem Post, and he's been following the Jonathan Pollard case since the story broke. His new book about it is called Territory of Lies. You were talking a little bit about how your story with Jonathan Pollard compared to the information that had already been made public. Another angle in your story was how he thought that Israel had abandoned him.
He was shocked, to put it mildly, when I first interviewed him. He had been arrested as he unsuccessfully sought asylum at the Israeli embassy on November 21st of 1985. He was actually on the embassy grounds but was kicked out and immediately arrested by the FBI. He was trying to protect Israel even after his arrest. He dissembled, he made up all sorts of lies about the involvement of other countries in order to protect Israel. Israel, the Israeli government, in its panic and in the shock that developed in the days and weeks immediately following his arrest, agreed to cooperate with the U.S. government in the investigation. And a team of U.S. investigators and prosecutors, State Department officials, intelligence community officials, went to Israel to receive evidence, to receive information about the Pollard operation. And those Israelis who were directly working with Pollard, his handlers, did testify against him. And the Israelis, in fact, made 163 documents available to the U.S. They returned 163 of the documents that Pollard had taken. And all of this was, of course, brought to Pollard's attention immediately after their return to the United States and Pollard's lawyers. And he was dumbfounded. He couldn't believe that his own handlers, the people with whom he had worked for an 18-month period, had so betrayed him. It was really unheard of in the annals of international espionage that a country whose agent had been captured, that country then went ahead and cooperated in the arrest and in the indictment, if you will, of that particular agent. He couldn't believe it. He felt not only, as I said, abandoned, but he felt betrayed. He didn't realize that the Israelis had at that point concluded that he, Jonathan Pollard, was expendable, that there was a much bigger issue at stake for the Israeli government, namely the entire fabric of the U.S.-Israeli intelligence cooperation, the whole U.S.-Israeli relationship. And the old adage at that point from the Mission Impossible show clearly was evident. If you are captured or killed, the secretary will disavow any knowledge of your operation.
Well, I think we're really not used to stories of somebody spying on an ally. Well, it's usually the other way around.
Right. Normally, we hear about normal espionage when countries spy against their adversaries. In this particular case, it was what they call in the intelligence business friendly espionage, countries spying on their friends, which is widespread. I want to make that clear. Countries, of course, spy on their adversaries, as they must, but they also spy on their friends, because it's important as well. A friendly country can certainly do things that could be damaging. Friendly countries occasionally get information which they don't want to share with another friendly country. All countries are reluctant to share any information which could damage their own security. The United States, when it comes to spying on its friends and allies, does it in an inobtrusive manner, in the sense that high-flying reconnaissance photography is used, satellites, or intercepting of communications. That kind of stuff goes on, not only against Israel, but against England or Canada or France or Japan or Mexico or any other country. It's part of the rules of the game. But going beyond the accepted rules of the game is when you actually run an agent in a friendly intelligence service. That is supposedly unacceptable, except there is one caveat. If that person happens to be what they call a walk-in, somebody who volunteers, somebody who comes to you and says, I have vital information which you need, which my country, my government doesn't want to share with you. It's very hard for any country, whether it's Israel or the United States or England or any country, to necessarily automatically reject a walk-in. Walk-ins are a separate category in and of themselves. And Jonathan Pollard was a walk-in. He approached the Israelis. The Israelis didn't approach him. He came and said, I want to help you. They checked him out. They were nervous. There was some concern that he may be a plant. It was a sting operation, some Israelis feared. But after checking him out and discovering that he was the real thing, that he had incredible access, they made sure that that walk-in didn't walk out. And that's when the money came into the game.
Now, he had access because he was working for the Anti-Terrorist Alert Center in American Naval Intelligence. And he thought that America was holding back information from the Israelis that the Israelis should have for their own security. What do you think, having analyzed the information that's been presented so far, was the U.S. holding back documents that they should have been sharing with Israel?
The question is, should. I mean, that's the key word. There's no doubt that the U.S.-Israeli intelligence cooperation is widespread. Both countries share a great deal of information with each other, maybe 80 or 90% of what the other party would like to know, they share. But no two countries, no matter how friendly, share everything. Certain information is reserved. Certain information you don't share with an ally, because even in the process of sharing that information, you could damage what they call the sources and methods, the way the information was collected, whether it was collected through an agent or collected electronically by breaking codes or intercepting communications. And in the process of sharing sometimes information, you could tip off a hostile third party that party had been penetrated one way or another. And so some information you don't share with anybody. Secondly, you never share with any country, no matter how friendly, the sources and methods, how the information was collected. There's no need to share that kind of information. Israel would never share it with the United States, and the U.S. would never share it with Israel. A third reason why sometimes information is not shared, and this motivated Pollard to a large extent, is that even if information is authorized for release to a friendly country, and he did see in the course of his work some information that was authorized for release to Israel but was not given, the reason it was not given is that in the course of this intelligence cooperation, it's usually a quid pro quo arrangement. You scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. The U.S. will ask Israel for certain information and Israel will respond depending on how forthcoming the U.S. is on other information that Israel wants. So sometimes countries hold back certain information because they want to use it as a carrot to extract other information from the other country. So there's a variety of reasons why some information would not necessarily have been shared with Israel.
I want to talk with you a little bit more specifically about the information that Pollard handed over to Israel. But first, we're going to take a short break. Wolf Blitzer is my guest, Washington bureau chief for the Jerusalem Post and author of a new book on the Pollard case called Territory of Lies. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Wolf Blitzer has been covering the Jonathan Pollard case from the beginning, and he's the one journalist that Pollard chose to speak with in prison while awaiting sentencing. Blitzer's new book on the Pollard case is called Territory of Lies. Pollard is the only American ever convicted of spying on his country for Israel. Pollard is now serving a life sentence. We were talking about spying on an ally. Tell us a little bit about the kinds of documents that Jonathan Pollard turned over to Israel.
Well, most of those documents dealt with Arab military capabilities and Soviet weapon systems that were coming into the Arab world. They were technical documents for the most part, and they were very, very important as far as Israel was concerned. Some of the early documents dealt with serious chemical and gas warfare production capabilities, locations of plants, and these kinds of things. Extremely sensitive information, which the U.S. had collected in various means and which Pollard made available to the Israelis.
When Pollard first approached Israel to spy for them, he was turned down by Mossad. The people who picked him up was, tell me if I'm pronouncing this right, the acronym is LACM.
LACM.
LACM, thank you. And this is the Defense Ministry's Office of Scientific Liaison.
Since Pollard's arrest, it's been disbanded. But it was a small scientific intelligence gathering unit in the Defense Ministry run by a veteran Israeli spy, Rafi Eitan, a 40-year veteran, someone who had been involved personally in the capture of Adolf Eichmann in Argentina in 1960, someone with a long history of espionage. And one of the master spies of Israel. He was in charge of this intelligence gathering unit in the Defense Ministry, which decided that it was appropriate to go ahead and run Pollard.
I guess one of the questions is, how high up did this knowledge go? How far into Israeli security did they know that there was an American spying for Israel?
Rafi Eitan says that he did have authority to run Pollard. He doesn't say where that authority came from. He has been silent on that. My sense is he did have a built-in authority. He felt he had a built-in authority, and I guess you could make a case that he had that authority. The top ministerial leaders at the time, the prime minister, the defense minister, the foreign minister, they all denied that they had any knowledge of this operation. They also denied that they gave any authority to it, of course. And the two commissions of inquiry that were established in Israel, one chaired by Abba Eban, who was then chairman of the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, the Israeli parliament, and a second government-appointed commission, the Rutenstreich-Zur Commission, both concluded that Rafi Eitan ran Pollard on his own and didn't have authority, and he bears the responsibility for this decision. What undermined the Israeli argument that this was an unauthorized rogue operation is that shortly after Pollard's arrest and conviction, Rafi Eitan was granted a major job in Israel. He was given the chairmanship of the Israel Chemicals Company, the largest government-owned company in the country, which didn't seem to the U.S. as much of a punishment for him. And the other thing that undermined Israel, of course, and undermined Pollard tremendously, was the fact that Pollard's first handler, an Israeli Air Force colonel named Avi M. Sella, was named to become commander of one of the largest Israeli air bases exactly on the eve of Pollard's sentencing. And it didn't look as if Sella was being punished either by getting this plum assignment. He, at that point, was on the fast track to becoming commander of the Israeli Air Force. So the whole issue of whether or not this was a rogue, unauthorized operation, of course, was blurred by the behavior of the Israeli government itself.
Do you think that the Pollard story is still damaging relations between the U.S. and Israel?
In the intelligence cooperation, there is still a very, very bad feeling on the part of many American officials. They felt they were burned badly. They operate on what they call the cockroach school of espionage, namely that if you see one cockroach in the kitchen, you better believe there are a lot of others in the plumbing hidden somewhere. And they're suspicious about that. They worry about whether there are other Pollards. They worry if there was a so-called Mr. X, another U.S. Intelligence official feeding information to Israel. They don't have any evidence. They've been searching for this Mr. X now for 3.5 years. They haven't been able to find him. But if in fact, there was such a person, which the Israelis strongly deny. But it has left a bad taste. Now, having said that, I will also go on to say that fundamentally, the overall U.S.-Israeli relationship remains strong. It's a relationship of friends and allies, and it's very close in terms of economic, military, and political cooperation. But there's no belittling the enormity of the Pollard affair. It has had a lasting impact on the relationship, even though some of the worst aspects of it have been contained.
Do you think Israel will ever step in on Pollard's behalf?
There's no doubt in my mind that the Israelis would very much like to see Pollard paroled and deported and allowed to live out his life in Israel quietly. Many senior officials in Israel feel very guilty that they were not only forced to abandon Pollard, but eventually to hang him, to provide information to the U.S. that was used against him. They know there are other Israeli spies out there in the world and sitting in dangerous spots in the Arab world and elsewhere who are waiting and watching and very carefully monitoring what Israel can do to help Jonathan Pollard, who, after all, from the Israeli point of view, was a loyal agent. He wanted to help Israel, and now he's paying a tremendous price for that decision. But I have no doubt that the Israelis would like to get Pollard to Israel at some point down the road. He will technically become eligible for parole, Jonathan Pollard, after serving a total of 10 years, meaning at the end of 95, early 96. Whether or not, of course, he gets parole is another matter. But my own guess is that ironically, given this close overall U.S.-Israeli relationship, at some point down the road, both countries will have a tremendous desire to get this a tragic episode once and for all behind them and to move on. And at some point down the road, I suspect there will be a political deal tying up all of the loose ends, including getting Pollard to Israel. But that's going to take some time.
Are you still in touch with Pollard or his wife, Anne?
I've written to both. It's very hard to get in to the prison. The only other reporter that did get in to see Pollard after the sentencing has been Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes, who did get in and was forced to sign some agreements that the Naval Intelligence would be able to review anything that Pollard said and delete from broadcast some information which could damage national security. But I've made repeated requests to get in to see Pollard again, to see his wife, and I've been routinely turned down. I've been in touch directly with the wardens of the various prisons, with the Justice Department, with the Bureau of Prisons, and I haven't been successful, although I've tried.
In your book, you say that you've thought of Pollard as the son of the American Jewish community run amok.
When I first met Pollard and I heard his motivations, and he went through his whole background in South Bend, Indiana, where he was a kid growing up, small Jewish community. He was one of the only Jewish kids in his public school and high school. His father is a distinguished professor at Notre Dame University, head of the Cancer Lab Research Institute there. When Pollard told me about the fights that he used to get into, the other kids picking on him, calling him anti-Semitic names. When he told me about his frustration in college, in graduate school at Stanford, and then at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University in Boston, when he told me about his frustration in wanting to go and settle in Israel, join the Israeli army, become an Israeli fighter, and his parents discouraging him, telling him, finish college, get a job, don't go, not wanting to lose him to a foreign country, even though they were tremendously supportive of Israel and identified with Israel. They wanted their son here in the United States. And when Pollard went through his own love for Israel, his high school science program, he spent the summer between his junior and senior year in high school at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Rehovot in Israel, where there was a program for gifted kids. And he really identified with Israel. Israel was really a manifestation of his Judaism. It was more than the actual religious aspects of being a Jew. He really identified with Israel. And this notion of wanting to help Israel, it just dawned on me when I was hearing his side of the story in the Petersburg Penitentiary that day. I just said, you know, this Jonathan Pollard seemed like a son of the American Jewish community run amok, that he just went off the deep end in his own passionate commitment to Israel, and he did things that he certainly should not have done.
You've been covering this story for the Jerusalem Post. Do you want to compare how this story has played in Israel and the United States?
Well, in terms of the facts, it's basically been roughly the same. But in Israel, there is a much greater nowadays grassroots sympathy and support for Pollard. They feel, the public, at least wide segments of the Israeli public, feel that the government mishandled this whole operation. They feel that Pollard was betrayed and made a scapegoat, if you will, and he was the spy left out in the cold, that the Israeli operatives who were involved managed to escape and they're living in Israel. Pollard was never helped in terms of his escape, and a lot of people in Israel, in fact, are sympathetic to him, and I would say that's probably the biggest difference, the amount of sympathy for the Pollard family in Israel as opposed to in the United States.
My guest, Wolf Blitzer, is the Washington bureau chief for the Jerusalem Post. Do many of the people who just know you by your byline assume that you're Israeli?
Yes, because I've been writing for the Jerusalem Post for about 15 or 16 years. They assume I'm an Israeli. I'm not an Israeli. I'm an American, originally from Buffalo, New York. But because I write for the Jerusalem Post, they simply assume that I'm an Israeli citizen. I don't have Israeli citizenship. I just have U.S. Citizenship.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time. I'm very appreciative.
Wolf Blitzer's new book on the Jonathan Pollard spy case is called Territory of Lies, and it's published by Harper & Row. Blitzer is the Washington bureau chief for the Jerusalem Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with actor John Hurt. He starred in the film The Elephant Man, played Caligula in I, Claudius, and Quentin Crisp in The Naked Civil Servant. He's now starring in Scandal, the new film about the Profumo affair, a British sex scandal of the early 60s. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lynn Sharon Schwartz is deliberately vague about her latest novel, Leaving Brooklyn. The book's main character has an eye affliction, so does Schwartz, but the two may or may not have other things in common. Coming up, Lynn Sharon Schwartz on blurring the line between memoir and fiction. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker plays some records that haven't all made it onto the charts, but have made it onto the Tucker Top 5. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Field of Dreams. Kevin Costner stars as an Iowa corn farmer who plays host to the spirits of baseball past. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. President Bush today urged American chemical makers to work harder at to keep their products out of the hands of illegal drug dealers. At the International Drug Enforcement Conference in Miami, the president said few Americans are aware that illegally diverted barrels of dangerous chemicals clearly marked with U.S. corporate logos are routinely seized in the jungles of Colombia. The Chemical Manufacturers Association took issue with the president's comments, saying it sounds as though the president is, quote, unfamiliar with the law and with what the chemical industry has been doing to help prevent the misuse of their products. The president released a statement today on the upcoming Panamanian election. Bush warned Panama's government that the United States will not recognize what the statement called fraudulent election results engineered by General Manuel Noriega. NPR's Jim Angle has more.
The Noriega regime promised free and fair elections on May 7th and that international observers would be permitted to observe them, the president's statement said. But in recent weeks, the president charged, the Noriega regime has taken steps to commit systematic fraud. Through violence and coercion, said the president, the Noriega government threatens and intimidates Panamanian citizens who believe in democracy. The president complained that the Panamanian government is attempting to limit and obstruct the presence of observers. The days of rule by dictatorship in Latin America are over, the president said. They must end in Panama as well. I'm Jim Angle with the president in Clearwater, Florida.
A delegation from the 22-member Arab League called on Secretary of State James Baker today with mixed results. He endorsed efforts by the League to stop the fighting in Lebanon, but Baker disagreed with the Arab ambassadors on two other key items. We get details from Barry Schwide.
The Arab delegation urged Baker to reopen the PLO office in Washington now that the U.S. is talking to the PLO. Baker said he isn't going to do that, and a State Department official said U.S. policy on the office hasn't changed. It was closed 13 months ago after Congress declared the PLO a terrorist group. Also, the Arab delegation failed to get Baker to back away from an Israeli proposal for elections on the West Bank and in Gaza. Clovis Maksud, the League's representative in the U.S., said the proposal is a charade designed to undercut the PLO, but Baker stressed it could be a positive step toward an overall settlement. On Lebanon, there was agreement. The fighting should stop, and the Arab League, which intends to send in soldiers to keep the factions apart, is engaged in a worthwhile effort. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Jordan's King Hussein has named a military man and a close friend as the new prime minister after price riots shook the country. In the aftermath of the violence, the king promised parliamentary elections in the next for the first in 22 years. Details from NPR's Deborah Amos.
Jordan's new prime minister is Zayd Ben Shaker, the architect of Jordan's military establishment. Ben Shaker has little experience in economic affairs, but he's popular with the army and with Jordan's Bedouin tribes. The price riots that resulted in more than 9 dead and scores injured began in southern Jordan, the stronghold of the Bedouins, the most loyal supporters of the king. The protesters took to the streets, burning government buildings and banks after the government raised prices in an agreement with the International Monetary Fund. The new government is committed to the austerity measures worked out with the IMF and to prepare for parliamentary elections. In an interview today, King Hussein said the riots could have been prevented if the government had been more open. In Jordan, this is Deborah Amos.
Human testing of a new AIDS drug derived from a Chinese cucumber plant has been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Researchers say the drug is the only agent shown to selectively kill AIDS-infective cells in the test tube. Stock prices rose to their highest level in 18 months. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped more than 29 points to close at 2418.99 on 191 million shares of volume. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and it's time again for the Tucker Top 5. Rock critic Ken Tucker has the survey of 5 new songs that have made it onto his chart.
Counting down this top 5, we have Roachford, an English soul singer who is said to have been discovered by last year's breakthrough soul man, Terence Trent D'Arby. Like D'Arby, Roachford displays a stylistic admiration, shall we say, for his role models. His debut album is filled with musical references to James Brown, Marvin Gaye, and Curtis Mayfield, among others. There are also moments on Roachford's first single, which is called Cuddly Toy, when his phrasing reminds me of white rhythm and blues singers such as Boz Scaggs and Delbert McClinton. As all of this suggests, Roachford right now is little more than an accumulation of influences, but Cuddly Toy is an impressive synthesis of them. The author of the next record, Peter Case, used to be the leader of a terrific Los Angeles rock band called the Plimsolls. They went nowhere, so he went solo, and 2 years ago, he put out a collection of original folk songs that was extremely intelligent, earnest, and dull. But many of my colleagues just raved about that record, and have thus encouraged the creation of this new Peter Case album, which is called The Man with the Blue Postmodern Fragmented Neo-Traditionalist Guitar. Those sarcastic references to Wallace Stevens and Picasso do an excellent job of suggesting the album's pretensions. But as self-conscious as his music has become, there are a couple of very good songs here that defy Peter Case's archness. Here's one of them, called Charlie James.
Had a whole lot of money. One day. The very next day I did not have dime. Looking on down the road, as far as I could see, I thought I saw my old time used to be.
Like Peter Case, Tim Finn used to lead a rock band. His was the New Zealand group called Split Enz, a big success in their homeland and a failure over here. When Split Enz split up, Tim's younger brother Neil Finn formed the group Crowded House, which has had a number of worldwide hits. Now, after a silence of 3 years, Tim Finn has put out a solo album, and instead of making a commercial pop record to compete with his brother, he's written a bunch of chatty, discursive songs whose tunes are clear but whose messages aren't. Singing in a chalky, conversational voice, Tim Finn isn't going to burn up the record charts with a thoughtful song like Young Mountain, but his music is an articulate pleasure.
Time to sing a travel song for all the days that come and go as we move on. Erotic stomach heat wave burning in my memory. Travel over hills and plains, see the hidden valleys, golden glass of flame, mother tongue that picks away your secret fear. History will disappear.
Fabulous Thunderbirds have a new record out called Powerful Stuff that's not as powerful as the band seems to think, but it's got one song well worth hearing. Buried at the bottom of an album of standard white blues bluster, after almost an hour of macho prattle about how she's hot and she's always been my woman but never my wife, lead singer Kim Wilson tackles the old soul ballad Raining in My Heart. The phony growl in his voice is suddenly gone, and we finally get to hear what a rough, tough blues man says while he's lying alone in bed.
Raining in my heart since we've been apart. I'm
number one song on this top five today is taken from a compact disc maxi single, as it's called. It contains a couple of new Elvis Costello recordings not available on his current release, Spike. One of these songs is You're No Good, a cover of Linda Ronstadt's 1975 number one hit, and that's an especially ripe, ironic choice. Ronstadt recorded Costello's song Allison a decade ago. It was an interpretation of the song that Costello particularly disliked, finding her singing stiff and false, and he said so in interviews. This despite the fact that he was probably getting a substantial amount of his income from the royalties from Ronstadt's recording. So you can listen to this version of Ronstadt's biggest hit as either an act of spite or of conciliatory homage. Either way, it sounds pretty terrific.
Feeling better now that we're through. Feeling better now I'm over you. I learned my lesson from the start. Now I know how you really are. You no good, you no good, you no good, baby, you no good. Gonna say it again, you no good, you no good, you no good, baby, you no good.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Sharon Schwartz has a new novel called Leaving Brooklyn. It's the story of how a 15-year-old girl seeks a more adventurous life than the secure middle-class one provided by her loving parents. Like the narrator of her novel, Schwartz grew up in Brooklyn, and although Schwartz says Leaving Brooklyn is fiction, not autobiography, it's written in the form of a memoir.
I was trying to write another novel, which was going to be a big and rather grandiose novel about contemporary issues, just the sort of thing I've never done and probably am not suited for. And I was having a lot of trouble. I really couldn't get going on this other novel. So I thought, just to get the juices flowing, I'll just write about something I know from my past. I'll write about my eye, because the girl in the book has a lazy eye, a very peculiar eye. And I thought, I'll write about that. I have it, too. And I got started, and of course it was a memoir, and I thought it was leading to nothing. It was just something to take up my time. And soon it just grew and grew, and I was making things up, and it took that form.
The girl in this book, Audrey, is 15 years old and lives in Brooklyn, in a middle-class Jewish neighborhood. And she thinks of Brooklyn not so much as a place, but as a state of mind. Would you describe the state of mind that Brooklyn represents to you in the period of, the early 50s?
It was the early, post-war and early middle 50s. A state of mind, precisely, because Brooklyn is many, many little neighborhoods, and they're not all middle-class, provincial, Jewish, as the one I was writing about. The state of mind is one where people tend to, the main value is safety and hiding. If you live quietly and don't make waves, you'll get through life without too much damage being done to you. And this was a Jewish neighborhood, and people were devastated when they learned by the war and then the aftermath of the war, when the revelations about the concentration camps. There was reason for them being frightened and for wanting to be safe and for wanting to raise their children in a safe environment. They were very decent. But, of course, decency has its limitations, and it if you concentrate on decency and safety, you leave out much of what is adventurous in life and, of course, adolescence. And my particular adolescent in the book wants just that, the adventure.
The adventure that the girl in your book gets is through an affair that she has with her eye doctor. And he's 37 years old. She's 15. He touches her leg. She touches him back. And they end up having sex at her eye doctor appointments. And the incredible thing is that although she really doesn't know what she thinks of this as a relationship, she doesn't think of herself as being damaged by it. It's the adventure she's been looking for. It's the education she's been looking for. And I think it's very interesting that you've turned it into that. You know, what I was expecting when I was reading was the damage.
Well, yes, and I know that readers will expect that, and this may be a controversial issue or even offensive to some. Fiction is very different from real life. Naturally, if this happened in real life, now it would be considered child abuse, and I and most people would be horrified. We'd send this, you know, have this doctor arrested. But fiction is something else. In fiction, the boundaries of experience are wider. I mean, for a young girl of 15, how many ways are there to find things out? There's travel, there's reading, there, you know, maybe I could name 6 or 8 primary ways of knowing. But sex is certainly one of the important ones. And, as you know, adolescents, that's what they're mostly curious about. She's not emotionally engaged. She's really in it for what she can find out, for the excitement of it.
There's a scene I'd like to have you read from the novel. And this is a scene in the eye doctor's office where the doctor is telling Audrey that he's sorry that he still has to keep charging her parents for these visits, even though they're having sex during these visits. But if he didn't charge the parents, then the parents would be suspicious and they'd have to call off their affair.
Okay.
And he's confessing to her how obsessed he's become with her.
Okay, I'll start. It's in the middle of a speech of his. I count the days till you come. Can you understand how humiliating it is for a grown man to feel this way about a practically a child? Do you know there are moments when I want to steal you away, run somewhere with you? There's something in you I have to have. My God, it's like some awful thing you read in the papers. On he went, and I sat opposite him, naked, compelled to hear. I wanted to cover my ears, but that was infantile and wouldn't help anyway. The words would keep breaking on me in waves, only muffled. It was like being possessed, he said. He knew the situation was impossible, but he was a prisoner. I drove him wild. He was drowning in it. He even named unmentionable parts of my body and what they made him feel, which made me want to die of shame, for it was one thing to do it and another to say it. All of it in disjointed phrases that I recognized from reading great books as the worst kind of banalities. Had he known me in the slightest, he would have prepared something elegant and literary.
I love that ending about how he should have prepared something elegant and literary. Well, this is a question I know you've been waiting to see how long it will take till I ask it. So here it comes. Did this happen to you when you were a teenager?
Well, that's something that I think I'm not going to be specific about because, not so much for privacy, although certainly partly for that, but why should I destroy the aura of the book? I mean, the book plays with the reader's imagination, in a sense, and the writer has a certain control over that. So I won't tell you.
Okay, fair enough. you know, part of the reason why I think I want to know is that you want to know if it's possible for a 15-year-old to go through an experience like this in reality and come out in reality the way you have her.
You mean come out as an adult?
Yeah, and to come out unscathed, to come out feeling like, well, yeah, I got the education I wanted.
I wouldn't say she's exactly unscathed. To me, what it is scathing is she understands or comes to understand her own cruelty, that she has been in a relationship with a man who he has not hurt her physically. He has not raped her. He has not treated her terribly except taking, you know, doing this. And he ends by caring about her, by seeing her as a person and wanting to know her and wanting the caring to come back to him. She treats him like an object the whole way through. And that's what she has to look at. That's what interests me, not whether she'll have the psychological scars. I don't know whether a girl in this situation would what kind of scars she would have.
I have a question about your parents, and I ask this not knowing whether they're living or not.
They're not living.
Okay. This just struck me as the kind of book that could really upset parents for two reasons. One is that there's this confession of feeling claustrophobic where you were brought up, really wanting to get out. And the other is the relationship between the main character and the eye doctor, the sexual relationship that they're having, and all the doubt that readers are going to have about whether you had that or not, and whether you did or not is none of our business, but the question is raised. And it's just the kind of book that I think, I don't know if you would have felt comfortable writing it if your parents were alive.
Well, you're right. My parents were wonderful, and I miss them, and I certainly would not have wanted to hurt them with this, but I didn't have to face it because they're dead. However, I think if they were alive and my mother had said, did this really happen, I would have said, nah, Mom, don't worry about it. It never happened. I made it up. I think what would have been more difficult is the way the parents have presented. When I wrote it, I thought the parents were presented very harshly. That's certainly not how I feel now. It is how Audrey felt and how I felt as a kid, as an adolescent. Audrey is very critical of the parents. What I do hope is very clear is that the judgment of the 15-year-old is certainly not my judgment. The book is not about the limitations of her parents. It's a little bit about the limitations of Brooklyn and about those parents. But really, it's about the self-delusions of an adolescent and how she's so greedy and so lustful and so stifled in what is indeed a dull environment that she can't see the people around her are human too, and that you don't have to have an exciting life or be an adventurous person to be a human being.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Lynn Sharon Schwartz's new novel, Leaving Brooklyn, is published by Houghton Mifflin. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Tonight, news from the coal fields down in Appalachia. There's been a coal strike going on in southwestern Virginia. 1,400 miners arrayed there against the Pittston Coal Company. And the union miners are using new tactics, some taken from the civil rights movement, including sit-ins involving wives and children of coal miners. Also, the animal rights issue as it pertains to circuses. There's been a call to take animals out of circuses entirely. We'll have the accusations of mistreatment and the rebuttal to that argument, and some music being played on the kora, the 21-string instrument of West Africa.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Baseball and fantasy have had a long, seamless relationship. For many fans, W.P. Kinsella's novel, Shoeless Joe, captured it best. The book's now been made into a movie starring Kevin Costner, Burt Lancaster, and James Earl Jones. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
When some crazy hears the voice of God and builds a 300-foot backyard altar out of tin cans and string, architectural scholars call that a folly. In other words, a work of such colossal nuttiness and misplaced conviction that it can stir in us a certain awe. In that sense, Field of Dreams is a folly. In fact, it's a folly about a folly. And as terrible a movie as it is, I'm a little bit stunned by it. Stunned by how the high-concept, low-imagination movie industry could have backed and marketed such a nitwit but grandiose vision. Field of Dreams is about what happens when a farmer named Ray Kinsella, played by Kevin Costner, starts hearing a whispery voice in the cornfields. The voice tells him, in so many words, to clear some of his cropland and build a baseball diamond on it. And so he does. Whereupon Shoeless Joe Jackson and the other White Sox who were banned from baseball after the 1919 World Series scandal show up to play on Ray's new diamond. Before long, the voice is telling Ray to facilitate all sorts of other dumb little miracles. To hunt up an elusive 60s author, played by James Earl Jones, and get him to join in on the do-gooding. And then to hunt up Doc Graham, who got to bat in only one inning of professional baseball, and who's played here by Burt Lancaster.
I never got to bat in the major leagues. I'd have liked to have that chance, just once. To stare down a big league pitcher. To stare him down, and just as he goes into his windup, wink. Make him think you know something he doesn't. That's what I wish for. Chance to squint at a sky so blue that it hurts your eyes just to look at it. To feel the tingle in your arm as you connect with the ball. To run the bases, stretch a double into a triple, and flop face first into third. Wrap your arms around the bag. That's my wish, Rickenseller. That's my wish.
It's great to see Lancaster, those teeth, and that look of all-American persuasiveness in his eyes. And in fact, all of the movie's casting, by Marjorie Simkin, is brilliant. But that clip gives you an idea of the sappiness of the dialogue, and maybe even of the pointlessness of the whole enterprise. This movie exists mainly to make American males feel all creamy and sensitive, to reduce them to tears and let them feel manly at the same time, since those tears are about baseball and America and the goodness of earth and corn. The movie is elaborately designed and gorgeously filmed. Every shot has the red-tinted glow of an Annie Leibovitz photograph. And Robinson's script is clever in a way. It's very wet, but whenever it can, it makes a joke about its own wetness. It lets Costner be a baseball mystic and a 30-something skeptic at the same time. Field of Dreams is an attempt to tap the religious urge lying dormant in an irreligious society. We may not believe in the doctrines of the church, but we sure believe in the ritualistic beauty of baseball. And there are audiences who find that belief so touching that Field of Dreams usually plays to tear-soaked crowds. As for me, I watched it not crying, but gaping. And you might do the same. Follies this enormous don't often find their way to a theater near you.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we talk with espionage novelist Frederick Forsyth, the author of The Day of the Jackal, The Odessa File, and The Dogs of War, tells us about researching illegal arms deals and terrorist kidnappings. Boogie-woogie pianist Marsha Ball joins us in our weekly performance spot, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone comments on the Lincoln Center tribute to Bette Davis. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Ockerty. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.